Mr. Cribreel 3. Did you suffer from body infestations like lice in Normandy?
No, we didn't seem to, funny enough. Even in the worst conditions, they still came up and came up with fresh clothing. I suppose that was one of them. And regards your hair, most of us, although I didn't have them, had had their hair cut off completely. They were bald. It was recommended, actually. I didn't, but we certainly had very short haircuts. And then later on, they did manage to get mobile baths going, you know, about once every few weeks. They get you down to a mobile bath, which came round, which was quite, shower, which was quite good. But otherwise, I mean, apart from mosquitoes and things, especially at night time, they were a bit of a pest. And we used to get these big bug things. I don't quite know what, like bees used to come out the wheat field at night. And they come out by the hundreds. And sometimes they get on the gun itself. And they used to get so fierce, you just couldn't get on it. Terrible things. I don't know what they called them, but they were quite like big bumblebees. They were horrible things. And they could sting. That was about the worst thing we had to put up with, as far as I can remember anyway, as regards that side of things.
Did you have any contact with the Norman civilians?
Very little. I think it was Colville, or was it Hauteville? I was outside one night. And not speaking French anyway, but we got involved in with a lot of French Canadians. Funny enough, of course, they were well away talking to the local talent. And but funny enough, Sunday mornings you'd see them come out from the village, all done up in their best gear, and they'd walk up the main road, which was alongside leading into Caen. They're all going off to church, and about an hour or so later they'd all come back again. And we used to just nod or say hello to them, and if we got anything in the way of chocolate or anything, we'd give it to the children. They hadn't seen anything like that for a few years. Mind you, the chocolate used to come out with the compo rations. It was like a brick. I think they enjoyed it there. But in spite of their villages being bombed and mortared, because we were under mortar fire every day, and the poor old villages used to take a real pounding, they were very good, you know. They didn't resent us at all. They were very, very, very good, I thought. Yes, got on very well with them. But we didn't have a lot to do with them, especially in the early days. You know, you were on the gun 24 hours a day. There was no time off as such. But what we did see of them, basically it was only Sunday mornings when they'd come up the road all in their Sunday gear and going off to church. And I always thought how brave they were. You know, they'd go straight up the main road, straight off into, I presume, into Caen. I don't know. There must have, perhaps there was a local church up the road. But it didn't put them off that there was a war going on all around them. Quite amazing they were.
What did you think of the German enemy in Normandy?
Well, they were a very powerful force, I must say. A great army, no doubt about it. Of course, being on the guns, we never came in close contact with them like the infantry did. We used to see quite a lot of them, because, I mean, a lot of the prisoners, they'd march back to the big pens down near the beaches where they used to keep them there before they brought them, sent them back to Blighty. They were pretty tough fighters, and most of them, I saw anyway, were very grubby uniforms and unshaven. So, I mean, they'd been at it fighting, I suppose, from, I don't know, perhaps day one onwards. But most of them seemed to be glad to be out of it. I think they would be too, because it was colossal, them. I mean, most days, some of the cruisers down off the beaches would be sending rockets over, or 15-inch shells over our heads into Caen or wherever. We had the spotter planes up directing gunfire. They were like little tailor craft. There was just a pilot and a chap in the back, observer, with his wireless set, and he would register the fall of shot from the big guns. And when they were up, our instructions were, if we fighted any, saw any German fighters coming roaring across, we had to warn the tailor craft, the plane, that what was happening, and to get them down as quickly as possible. And we had to put a couple of shells close to the observer in the tail to let him know, you know, because he'd be so involved with headphones, he wouldn't hear anything. I don't suppose the pilot would. But they packed it up in the end because I think we got a bit too close for comfort. They were a bit worried. I mean, we were supposed to fire as close as we could to the plane to give him warning that the fighters were around. So in the end, they packed that idea in. They said he was getting a bit too close with the shells that we used to send up. But they're highly manoeuvrable, these planes. I mean, they dip straight down under a tree or something. And they had a very dangerous job watching the fall of shot. And, of course, they'd wireless or radio back to the guns, so close they were to the target or what. I think they were a very brave crowd.
How did you feel about getting out of Normandy in August 1944?
Well, I wasn't bothered about it. I was disappointed in the fact because we'd once again got established, and I mean, it wasn't any fun, but at the same time, you just seem to want to stay with your unit. And you knew if you're going back to Blighty, you'd only be going off to another part of the globe somewhere, to another war, which could have been out east. Didn't particularly want to go there, or wherever. And I felt, well, this is the nearest place to home anyway, only across the channel. And, you know, you just wanted to stay with all your mates, really, and your own gun crew. You just sort of feel you're part of a family while you're with them. And we hadn't had any casualties except one that day since I'd been there. One casualty, that's all. So, I mean, we're still a good team. And you get used to working with the same people.
Going back to that incident that you described with the men in the trench who got the cannon fire.
Yes.
Who disposed of the bodies?
Well, what happened was there was a first aid post not far behind. They had a special name, not war graves, something or other. I forget what they actually called themselves now. But they came out very quickly the next morning and just removed one of the identification tags and put them in blankets and quickly reburied them there. For later on, of course, they would be removed and put into proper graves, but there was no time to do that then. It was just remove identification tags and whatever and put a blanket around and put them back in.
Did they have a funeral service?
No, there was no time for that. I always remember the first things I noticed when we landed, coming up this old road, or by the side of the road there was German graves, and all that marked them with their rifles and the whole thing with the helmet stuck on the top. I mean, there'd been no time to. They just dug them, stuck them under a bit of earth, and rifle and the helmet on top just let people know they were there. I mean, later on, of course, they would be removed and buried properly. There was too much going on for the living to worry about the dead. I mean, even when I went in a few weeks after D-Day, D-Day, we were still pushing through bodies floating in the sea. After that time, there were so many of them. I mean, there were a lot of casualties, as you know, especially on the American beaches, where they lost nearly 3,000 in one day.
Were there many of these bodies floating in the sea?
I only saw two as I came in on the landing craft. I only saw two. But I was surprised, you know, in a sense, that they were still there. It seemed so wrong. You know, I could see them going in and out with the waves, as you might say. Perhaps they'd been further out and had just come in with the tides, I don't know. But I was a bit horrified, actually, to see bodies. I suppose it was my first instance of that sort of thing, going to France. Because in spite of all the things that happened in this country during those years, I hadn't come across any of our own troops being killed.
Well, later on, you the end of the war, after VE Day, you were in Austria, and I think, did you have see anything of the Russian troops there?
Well, a certain amount, you know, they kept to themselves as much as we did, but the Austrians themselves were terrified of them, I think. I mean, after all, the Germans had given the Russians a rough time when they invaded Russia. And I think now they were very scared of them. All they kept saying, Ruskies coming, Ruskies coming. They were dead scared of them. They didn't want to get involved with the Russians. We didn't have anything to do with them. They kept to themselves, and so did we. They were a pretty fierce-looking crowd, I must say.
What were they doing when you saw them?
Well, mostly they were chasing and running around the streets. They seemed to be, well, I don't know if they were drunk or what they were up to. But they commandeered a lot of cars, of course, and they were just tearing around the streets. They didn't seem to have any purpose in what they were doing. I must admit, the British troops were there, were very, very orderly, in comparison anyway. So I was only there in Vienna a couple of days. I was interested in sightseeing for the couple of days. I was waiting for transport back to Klagenfurt. And then was it St. Stephen's Cathedral Church there? I remember going and seeing, have a look at that. But then,
how long after VE Day was that? A few months.
It was a few months. I'm not accurate about that. But we were stationed in a house by Klagenfurt Station, and then we were called on at different hours of day and night to take these food trains, up to Vienna. And then back again on another train. But I was fetched by jeep, in actual fact, when they came for my mate and myself. Picked us up, took us back by jeep all the way back down to Austria again.
What was the attitude of the Viennese towards the British troops?
Well, it seemed fine. I know I went to the first pub I went into there when I was in Vienna. I said, you know, let's go and have a drink. I went, and funny enough, I sat down there and I was just wondering, do you wait to be served, or do you go up and help yourself? And a woman came up and sat down to us. She said, do you mind if I join? She spoke perfect English. And she'd been a teacher, teaching English in Vienna when all this went on. And she was fine. She was nice to talk to somebody in English. She said, oh, no, they'll come and serve you now. And we just asked her a few questions about living conditions and what it was like there, and was she going back, and she seemed to be quite happy to stay there, and hopefully she'd get back to teaching before long.
But so she was English?
She was English, yes. Yeah, so surprising she said, walk in while we're there.
What did she say about living conditions there?
Well, she said, of course, it had been very, very rough, but they'd survived all right, and she'd got some good friends there. Some of the children's parents she'd been teaching had sort of looked after her and that sort of thing. She had no intention of going back if she could possibly stay there. As I say, I was only there for a couple of days and then back down to Klagenfurt.